From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
The federal government actually had been surveilling my family dating back to my great-great-grandfather, who was one of the founders of the NAACP, who was very active here. And so we just felt that it was timely for America to understand exactly where Martin Luther King Jr. truly came from and how he came into being. And this truly is. And then the other thing is that this story, if you change the race of my grandfather, it would be the traditional raise yourself up by your own bootstraps American story. This was a guy that walked into this city, Atlanta, Georgia, with the one pair of shoes that he had slung across his back.
Isaac Newton Ferris Jr., former CEO at the King Center, grandson of Dr. Martin Luther King Sr. and nephew of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. In the release of Daddy King, published by Beacon Press, the new foreword was written by Ferris. There he shares what Daddy King meant to him as a family member. Originally published in 1980, Daddy King chronicles the life of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Sr. In the book, King Sr. recalls the joys and struggle of his journey, the pain of leaving his mother and father and siblings on the farm, the triumph of winning voting rights for African Americans in Atlanta, and the feeling of fatherly pride and anxiety as he watched his son put himself in danger at the forefront of the civil rights movement. Daddy King gives us an understanding of what hardship and experience of racism that Martin Luther King Sr. went through, and how he developed his method of political dissent that became a major influence on his son, Martin Luther King Jr. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Daddy King, an autobiography with Isaac Newton Ferris, Jr., In Black America.
I think that's where he got his strength from, and he actually had to leave Stockbridge for a while behind that incident,
right,
because they were threatening to kill him because of that. His mother was a very strong influence in his life, supported him when he came to Atlanta. As a matter of fact, got him his first car.
That Model T,
which helped him greatly, helped him to get his first church. Because in those days, churches didn't meet every Sunday. And so, preachers back in that day might pastor maybe more than one church. Because they didn't meet every Sunday. So having that Model T allowed him to get around the back roads of Georgia to spread the gospel.
In 1980, Martin Luther King Sr. published his memoir, Daddy King, an Autobiography, a chronicle that provides insight into the life and family that created Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Coming of age under poverty and the looming threat of racial violence, to preaching from the legendary Ebenezer Baptist Church pulpit for four decades. Candidly, he reveals his life inside the civil rights movement, illustrating the profound influence he had on his son. Born Michael King on December 19, 1899, to a family of sharecroppers in Stockbridge, Georgia, King Sr. came of age in the looming threat of violence at the hands of white landowners. Growing up, he witnessed family being crushed by the weight of poverty and racism and escaped to Atlanta at the age of 16 to work and to further his studies. From his mother, King Sr. learned how important it was to stand up for what was right. When he went on to become a pastor with his father-in-law at Ebenezer Baptist Church, it gave him a position from which he could reach out to those in power in order to make a difference. Recently, In Black America spoke with Isaac Newton Ferris, Jr., grandson of King Sr.
I think a lot of people really, you'd be surprised, don't realize that there is a Martin Luther King Sr. And there just would not have been a Martin Luther King Jr. without a Martin Luther King Sr. And I guess we could say that about every son who has a father. Mm-hmm. But I thought, the family thought, and the publishers agreed that in light of where we are in the country now and what's happening, that this is a timely story. It gives you a better appreciation, I think, for my uncle, because it really breaks it down for you and explains and shows you that he was just not a one-hit wonder, that he just, you know, didn't that his drive, his will to free not only his people but this country actually started really with my great-great-grandfather.
Right.
A lot of people don't realize that. Adam Daniel Williams.
Okay.
And one of the things that came out in the 90s, the media discovered that actually, you know, with the Freedom of Information Act and the release of information over time, the federal government actually had been surveilling my family dating back to my great-great-grandfather, who was one of the founders of the NAACP, who was very active here. And so we just felt that it was timely for America to understand exactly where Martin Luther King Jr. truly came from and how he came into being. And this truly is. And then the other thing is that this story, if you change the race of my grandfather, it would be the traditional raise yourself up by your own bootstraps American story. I mean, this was a guy that walked into this city, Atlanta, Georgia, with the one pair of shoes that he had slung across his back, you know, because he only had one pair and he didn't want to wear them out. So he walked into this town barefooted, no education, you know, went back to school, started in elementary school as a young adult, worked his way on up and finished Morehouse College. So it truly is an American story. And we just felt that it was time to re-release it. It was first done back in the 80s, and I just think a lot of people missed it. There were a lot of things happening back in the 80s, and it just kind of got shuffled under the radar. And the family and the publishers agreed that it was time to re-release it and bring this truly American story back to the public.
When one reads the book and understand Daddy King, and one can understand why Martin Luther Jr. Turned out the way he did, and the dichotomy between the two. Martin had a fierce commitment towards nonviolence and peace. His dad somewhat from time to time, but they both were committed to a cause.
Yeah, well, not to cut you off, but that was, you know, my grandfather was a very secure man,
right.
And he'd be the first to tell you, my son taught me to love.
Exactly.
The nonviolence, that is the one thing that Uncle Mel did not get from my grandfather.
Right.
He got the strength and the guts and the courage. But the nonviolent philosophy, no, did not come from my grandfather. My grandfather, if he were here today, would tell you, my son taught me to love. My son taught me not to hate. And so, you know, but there was other parts that my uncle, it's no coincidence that my uncle decided to move back here to Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
And that was not just because he wanted to be close to his family, he loved his father and his mother and my mother, his sister. But my grandfather, because of his political connections, could provide him the cover that he needed.
Right.
You know, my uncle knew that he was being surveilled.
Mm-hmm.
He knew because back in that day, a lot of the surveillance was relied upon through the local law enforcement, the Southern officers, a lot of which who were former FBI agents who would come back. And my grandfather and the then chief of police, Herbert Jenkins, were very close.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's my grandfather talks about that in the book. So that's another reason why we thought that it was important for people to know that there's another element here besides a father-son nurturing relationship, that there was also strategic reasons. There's a strategic alliance here that enabled my uncle to be the strong leader that he was. One more point on that, you know, it's well known that my uncle, you know, generated a lot of resources, money, all of which went into the movement. He never took any money personally. Well, he was able to do that because my grandfather provided a job for him at Ebenezer Baptist Church. So that innate, that gave him the financial independence not to be compromised. So there's a lot of connections there that I don't think people realize and will appreciate in reading the book.
And also in reading the book, your father forged alliances with William Hartfield, who was the mayor back in the day, that really came in handy as he grew older within the movement in Atlanta, but also assisted in him assist his son along the way.
Oh, no question about it. As I was saying earlier, I mean, clearly the reason he loved Atlanta, although truth be told, I mean, no one wants to admit it. Now, Atlanta did not want my uncle to come back here.
Right.
Quite frankly, because Atlanta probably was one of the best examples in the country of separate but equal.
Mm-hmm.
And so the black people here were like, look, I mean, we got our own schools, we got our own restaurants, we got our own stores, we got our own life here. We don't need you here coming back here messing it up, and we're not necessarily want to be integrated. And so that's another element that's explored in the book. But no question, those political ties enabled my uncle to be the person that he is. I mean, if you can imagine, if you're on the front line or if you're in a war, you need, you know, neutral, safe territory.
Right.
Where you know what's happening around you, where you know even if you and your allies can't necessarily control everything that's happening around you, you are at least in an environment where you know you're aware of everything that's happening around you. So even if you can't control it, you can kind of take, you know, you can place yourself in positions maybe not to be as affected by it.
What was it like reading about your mom in the book? Of knowing her commitment to education, being denied a teaching position when she had 2 degrees, but understanding how powerful she was back in the day.
It was very, it was very powerful doing that, and it kind of helped me to understand her better.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons why she ended up with 2 degrees is because she actually left here going to Columbia,
right,
in there to get an MBA. And she was not only the only black person in the class, she was the only female,
mm-hmm,
in the class. And they just did everything to thwart her from getting that degree, and unfortunately they ended up being successful, and she switched her focus to education, which I don't think she regretted, because mm-hmm, she had a long, great career at Spelman, and I still have Spelman women as I travel the country that come up to me today and talk about how much of an influence that she was. But particularly coming back to Atlanta and then confronting that again,
mm-hmm,
was particularly hard for her, because she had felt that she had grounded herself and kind of figured her way through life, and then come back. And as you said, I mean, this was a woman with 2 master's degrees, and the Atlanta School Board of Education would not give her a job until the mayor intervened. Here again, my grandfather, with his political connections, was able to come through. A great man. I mean, we've talked about how he's helped my uncle and my mother, but quite frankly, they're Atlantans today that still talk about how my grandfather helped them. He truly was a great man. I mean, this is a truly, I know I'm his grandson, and it would sound like I would, you know, naturally say this, but this is truly a great American story that I think people will enjoy and they need to know about.
I found it interesting in the book that regardless of their education or the lack thereof, your great-grandparents, no one allowed Martin Sr. to be taken advantage of. Your great-grandmother actually stood up and punched one of the mill owners because they were dissing Daddy King.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that's where he got his his strength from. Mm-hmm. And he actually had to leave Stockbridge for a while behind that incident.
Right.
Because they, you know, they were threatening to kill him because of that. His mother was a very strong influence in his life, supported him when he came to Atlanta. As a matter of fact, got him his first car.
Mm-hmm, that Model T.
Model T. That Model T, which helped him greatly, helped him to get his first church. Because in those days, you know, churches didn't meet every Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, preachers back in that day might pastor maybe more than one church because they didn't meet every Sunday. So having that Model T allowed him to get around the back roads of Georgia to spread the gospel.
If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Henson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio, and we're speaking with Isaac Newton Ferris, Jr., son of Daddy King's first child, Christina King Ferris, and former CEO of the King Center. Mr. Ferris, I found it interesting in the three parallels that when Martin, A.D., and your mom were courting, your granddad would always try to give the person that they were courting the third degree when they came to the house. But I found it interesting when your dad finally decided to talk to Daddy King about marrying your mom, he was steadfast in it, and he wasn't going to be bullied by your granddad.
He was not, and I think that's in part because he came from a similar
background.
Right. And but you're right about that third degree. I don't know if this is mentioned. I can't remember if this is mentioned in the book, but you know my grandfather had my uncle's wife picked out for him.
Right.
And it was not Coretta Scott King.
Exactly. As a matter of fact, he tried to sabotage him when he did visit them in Boston.
He did, because he knew who, there was a family here that he just knew that was the right match for his son.
Right.
But as fate would have it, that didn't end up being the case. But I mention it to say, to reference the closeness between my uncle and my mother. Mm-hmm. My mother was the first person in the family to meet Aunt Coretta. As a matter of fact, because of as I stated, you know, my grandfather had determined who my uncle was going to marry. And consequently, when he got ready to propose to her, he had to actually borrow the money from my mother.
Mm-hmm.
Because here again, he needed to do it in secret, and he was he met her while he was at BU doing his graduate work, and so he was totally dependent financially on my grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
For everything. So he couldn't, there was no way he could go and say, hey, Dad, I need to go ahead and pop the question, so can you help me get the ring? Now, he could have done that if he was going to marry the woman that my grandfather wanted him to marry.
Yeah, back in Atlanta. Right.
As a matter of fact, I understand, I got to ask my mother about this, but I understand that my grandfather had already selected the ring for her.
Oh.
But anyway, my uncle, you know, borrowed the money from my mother, and the rest is history. But I will say that, you know, once he saw, you know, the depth of feelings that my uncle had for my Aunt Coretta, he then, before they finally got married, he then turned and was doing the opposite. He was pushing them to hurry up and go ahead and get married, because he said, the way y'all are going, y'all gonna end up in trouble and make a mistake here. And so you need to go ahead and get married so that everything will be legitimate, because he saw the amount of affection between them. And so I think the last thing he wanted to happen is that, you know, my aunt would end up pregnant or something of that nature. So he jumped on board and then was the main cheerleader. Hey, you all need to go ahead and do this. And he loved my aunt. And I think if he were here today, certainly if he, I can tell you if he were here today, no disrespect, because she is still alive. I won't mention her name, the woman. But there's just no way that she could have been the life partner that my Aunt Coretta was to my uncle. And certainly you can make an argument that she was maybe in some ways a better partner in death than she was in life. I mean, we would not have a King Holiday were it not for my Aunt Coretta.
I found it interesting in the book where your granddad was committed to civil and civic advancement, but coupled with that, but also the economic equivalent to that, and his fierceness in going back, getting individuals to vote, but also going back to City Hall week in, week out, month in, month out, year in, year out, and walking past that white-only elevator.
Yes, yes. And that's another thing, and I alluded to this earlier about my uncle not being a fluke. You know, my uncle, as a young boy, saw my grandfather march on Atlanta City Hall
exactly.
over those drinking fountains. And I tell you, you know, people talk about the March on Washington, but at no point did my uncle ever fear for his life in leading the March on Washington. And nobody ever thought, okay, that his life would be in danger, you know, leading the March on Washington. I mean, when you talked about the March on Washington, they were talking about the logistics and how are we going to deal with all these people. Nobody ever thought about any physical harm.
Mm-hmm.
Atlanta, Georgia, you know, one of the former capitals of the Confederacy, a black man in the late 30s, early 40s, marching on Atlanta City Hall. I mean, even if you marched and you were a party of one and you didn't have any protesters with you, you were liable to be lynched.
Exactly.
Just for, you know, a party of one walking up the wrong way to City Hall, much less leading people in protest over, you know, the policies inside. So this obviously planted a seed in my uncle. And here again, that's another reason why we thought it was important to share this story, to show the linkages. And to show that this guy was not just a one-hit wonder, that there's real history of how this evolved.
Talk to me about your grandmother. They say behind every great man, there's a great woman. But your grandmother was truly, truly a great woman.
She was, and it's no question that rings true in the life of my grandfather,
mm-hmm.
and he talks about that in the book. First off, my grandmother was a very secure woman within herself,
right.
grounded in the right way, because understand now that Ebenezer Church that is on the National Historic Register of Places, the place where my grandfather preached. My grandfather built that church with his own funds. And understand that back in that day, that was considered a very large church.
Right.
Right? So this was a thriving church with a thriving membership. In comes into town this uneducated, uncouth, guy from Stockbridge, Georgia, who had a sister that the family had taken in.
That's Woody, right?
That's my Aunt Woody trying to help her out. She had a lot more training and education than my grandfather.
Right.
But here comes this guy who comes to visit one day his sister and meets my grandmother. And for him, you know, he immediately was attracted to her.
Right.
I don't know that my grandmother was immediately attracted to him. And I'm painting this picture because even though these were trying times within the black community, not just here in locally here in Atlanta, Georgia, but nationally. Mm-hmm. A.D. Williams was somebody.
He was a man.
He was the man, and so in the black world, this was, you know, a leading family.
Exactly.
And my grandmother was educated. I mean, she had gone, you know, to Marsh Brown and Spelman at that time was not a college. It was a
seminary.
It was kind of a preps. Yeah, prep school. So she was fully educated by the time that this guy showed up. Had been to college and was thought to be, you know, a pick. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were families across the country that wanted these families to unite. So, exactly. One, I think that speaks to her ability to look beyond the surface and to look into the man's heart and soul and to see something. And then I have to also, in that same note, say about my great-grandfather. He saw something in my grandfather because he took him in as well, mm-hmm, under
right.
his. And trust me, in that day, I mean, I know I talked about my grandfather and my uncle and my grandfather having picked out the woman for my uncle. Now, by this time, this was in the 50s. Now,
right.
Now we're talking about back in the 20s, and trust me, if the father didn't want you, you didn't marry.
It didn't happen.
Okay,
exactly.
That, I don't care if you had a sister that would lend you money for the engagement. It wasn't happening. I mean, it was not happening in that day. So my aunt, my grandmother could have fallen deeply in love,
mm-hmm.
Which he did with my grandfather, but had my great-grandfather, you know, signed off on it, it would not have happened. And so I also think that speaks to my grandfather, something naturally within him, before they were able to help him polish himself off and help him get into school and educate himself. And that's where my great-grandfather, by the way, was coming from. I
mm-hmm.
mean, he was like, he saw something in him, but he also was like, okay, son, now if you're going to be with my daughter, you know, you got to clean your act up.
Exactly.
I see a little potential, and I think you can clean it up, but you got to clean your act up, son. You got to get education. And that was his intent. That, aside from bettering himself, he wanted to be able to marry my grandmother, and my great-grandfather kind of laid it out for him.
Isaac Newton Ferris, former CEO at the King Center, grandson of Martin Luther King Sr., and nephew of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions at your future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Remember to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.